Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
As COVID-19 continues to dominate our lives, we remember another pandemic as it turns 40 years old next year, HIV/AIDS. We talk with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who recalls the first cases in the US four decades ago, plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. As we all continue to live with COVID-19 and hope is on the horizon for a vaccine soon, it's an apt time to also remember another pandemic, that of HIV/AIDS. In 2021, it will be 40 years since the first diagnosis of HIV/AIDS in the US, and one person has been a leading figure in the battle against the disease, someone we all know because of the current pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci was there at the beginning of the HIV/AIDS outbreak in this country, and for four decades has been an expert face and voice to the nation. I caught up with him recently to talk about his personal memories of HIV/AIDS, the fact there is still no cure despite breakthroughs in treatments, and to talk about those living and aging with HIV. Dr. Fauci, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
2021 marks a milestone in this country. It will be 40 years since the first diagnosis of HIV/AIDS. You, of course, are very much part of that landscape. Does it seem like 40 years ago, sir?
You know, in some respects, it seems like forever ago. But in some respects, for those of us who have been involved, as I have been, from literally the very first week when the reports came out from the MMWR, it seems very much like yesterday, because I still have flashes in my mind of those early years, which I'll never get out of my consciousness, of the extraordinary suffering and pain with a new disease that we didn't even have a name for it. And we certainly didn't have a cause for it, but we were just there trying to put Band-Aids on hemorrhages during that time. And then a lot of things have happened in 40 years, many of them really, really good. In the sense of therapies and prevention. So yes, it seems like forever and it seems like yesterday.
We're going to touch upon a little bit more of that as we go through the conversation. You've always been, it seems, at the center of people's attention, certainly with the current pandemic. But of course, we often forget that HIV/AIDS is a pandemic in itself. And I want to take you back to your meeting with Peter Staley, who is an activist for ACT UP. And you met him in the late 1980s, I believe. What were your impressions of Peter? Because you're still very much, I believe, in touch with him.
Well, more than in touch with him, he's one of my closest friends right now. So, I talk to Peter a few times a week at a minimum. So, the one thing that I got back then for Peter, but also for several of the other activists, were highly committed, very intelligent, passionate people who had a cause that history has shown was an extraordinarily productive cause. But at the time, they were doing uncharted waters. You know, they were poking at and challenging the well-established scientific and regulatory enterprise that had never been done before. So I think when you describe them, Peter included, and particularly because I know him well, but others, you know, Mark Harrington and Greg Gonzalez and David Barr and Jim Igo and on and on and on. I could spend the entire time naming them. There were so many important people. It was courage. I mean, they were very courageous. They were bucking against something that had never before been challenged. So in that respect, even back then, as they were challenging me, clearly more than, I mean, they were challenging me. Larry Kramer was trashing me in his own inimitable way. But even then, you had to have respect for them because you knew what they were doing, is that they were really on the right side of history right from the beginning.
You yourself were trying to change things as well, because you were trying to invite, obviously, these groups of people, you know, onto clinical trials and things. So you yourself were sort of like bucking a trend, I suppose, in a way as well, weren't you?
Oh, yes, I was. And it was at no small cost, because there were certain members of the scientific and regulatory community who were very upset at me. They thought I was, quote, the word they use office was selling out to the activists, compromising the scientific process, compromising the regulatory process, just to essentially cater to these rabble rousers, as they were felt to be. And I think that as time went on, those people who were criticizing me finally realized that they were not rabble rousers. They were people trying to gain the attention of authorities who inappropriately were not paying as much attention to them. But I definitely had my bumps and bruises from that too, because my own people, many of them in my own organization, were very concerned and upset at what I was doing.
We, of course, sadly lost Larry Kramer recently. As you said earlier in this interview, you had a very good relationship with him, over 30 years of a friendship. How did that affect you?
Well, it was a big loss. I mean, Larry was, you know, an iconic figure who I had a very, as he described it in his own words, quote, a complicated relationship. And it was complicated because it started off in a very confrontative way, him confronting me, not my confronting him, you know, and some of the things that he did to gain the attention of me, which he certainly did gain my attention, as well as for the scientific community. Larry was a very passionate person, very committed. He was an important part of the activist movement because he did not pay much attention to the fine-tuned details of the scientific process. He just was a, you know, an iconoclast in the best sense of the word. He would challenge everyone and everything. He felt the entire gay community were his children, as it were, his people, his tribe, and he would do anything to protect the safety and the health of those people. And sometimes to the extent that they rebelled against him. You remember when he wrote the book Faggots, there was a big pushback on the part of the gay community against him. But then he became the leader and the hero of the activist movement. And our relationship was very complicated. It started off very confrontative. And then as we got to know each other, we realized, both of us, that we wanted the same end game. We wanted to end this. We wanted to get treatments. We wanted to get prevention. And that's when we became closer and closer. But to his unusual, unique character, even as we became very close and were really, really good friends towards the end after 10, 15, 20 years, is that he would not hesitate for a moment to just blast me on something that he felt was not being handled correctly. But he wouldn't take it in the sense of doing anything wrong to me. I mean, we've had situations where we would be on television in a panel and he would be blasting the hell out of me, you know, calling me all kinds of names on public TV so that, you know, 10 million people were hearing it. And then I remember one or two or three or more instances when I would get home, walk in the door and the phone would ring, it would be Larry. He said, "Wow, wasn't that a great interview? How'd you like it?" He said, "Larry, you just trashed me in front of 10 million viewers. What do you mean? How did I like it?" But that was Larry. You had to accept him.
You went on to become his doctor later on in life. And also he underwent an organ transplant as well, which you were very much sort of part of. It sort of really set the scene and changed things a little bit for people who were living with HIV/AIDS, because he was quite a lot older to receive an organ transplant, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, we pushed and found someone for him who would be able to do it. It was quite successful. As you know, when Larry passed, he passed in his 80s. I mean, that is really something for someone who had been not only living with HIV, but who had a liver transplant and was on suppressive therapy for his liver transplant. That's most extraordinary. I think it speaks to the toughness and resiliency of Larry. But yes, I was very much involved in his care and in getting him set up for the liver transplant. But it was the beginning of a very important change in attitude of getting transplants for people who are living with HIV as opposed to just giving up on them and saying, well, they have HIV, therefore, why should we waste a liver transplant on them? Right now, not only transplants from uninfected people to them, but transplants between HIV-infected individuals or persons with HIV.
The other thing I wanted to put to you as well is, how do you deal with all of the attention that comes in your direction? Because, you know, we've just spoken about Larry and about Peter, and they are both friends, but as you've just said, they also challenged you. You're also challenged on a daily basis, you know, by other people who don't know you but make assumptions. How do you deal with all of that, Dr. Fauci?
Well, if the challenge is valid, you figure out how to address it. And if it can be addressed, you address it as appropriately as you possibly can. If it's just people attacking or, you know, making comments that aren't helpful or productive, then you just ignore it. And I've learned over the years how to compartmentalize and ignore things. I mean, you have to be careful that you do not get distracted from what your main goal is. Right now with COVID-19, my main goal is to develop therapeutics and vaccines to end the outbreak and to serve as a public health official articulating to the general public what they need to do to protect themselves from infection. That's what my entire life is right now. That's all I do. When people do things either in a flattering way or in a threatening way, which I get threatened often, I just consider that as peripheral noise and I can't get distracted by it. I just have to focus like a laser on what it is that I should be doing.
As we said at the top of this podcast, Dr. Fauci, next year is 40 years of the first diagnosis of HIV/AIDS in the US. Yet still today, we have no cure for HIV/AIDS. We have various other select medications and ways to select manage the condition. Do you think that we've sort of like stepped off the gas a bit when it comes to HIV/AIDS, regardless of the situation we find ourselves currently in across the world, obviously with COVID?
No, I think we continue to push very hard with HIV. In fact, just 2 days ago, we had the announcement of the data from HPTN-084, which was the use of injectable cabotegravir in women. It's, I think, one of the most important advances we've had in a while, because one of the issues that we've been challenged with is that obviously this is a global pandemic. In Southern Africa, it is dominated by the infection of young women. Some of the prevalences among women of childbearing age are striking and frightening, 40 to 50% in some prenatal and neonatal clinics. And we've never been able to get a good pre-exposure prophylaxis program for them. You know, pills every day, they don't take them as often, or they're put in a compromised position because their sexual partner would essentially rebel against them if they do that. They need a therapy that takes a few times a year that is effective. But we didn't know it was effective until we did a trial comparing it to oral Truvada. And what we found was something extraordinarily gratifying, that injectable cabotegravir in women in 084 was even better than daily oral Truvada. That is a huge advance for the prevention of HIV in women. So we are not taking our foot off the gas pedal when it comes to HIV. We still feel that we need to end the epidemic as we know of it, as an epidemiological phenomenon. In the United States by 2030, we started at 2020, so it's a 10-year program, decrease incidence by 75% in 5 years and by 90% in 10 years, which will bring us to 2030. I think that's achievable, and I think that we need to continue to push as hard as we can to implement the program that gets us there. So short answer to your question, we're in it all the way when it comes to ending this epidemic.
We are seeing a reduction in like new cases of HIV/AIDS here in the US and in certain parts of the world. But of course, people are getting older and living with HIV much more so than obviously back in the 80s, when sadly people would only live for maybe 1 or 2 years. But that in itself will bring its own medical complications, will it not, for them?
Absolutely. And that's the reason why we are paying attention to the medical conditions of people who have successfully beaten HIV. And by successfully beaten, I'm talking about the large, large number of people who are on one pill of three drugs a day with an undetectable viral load and a CD4 count that's reasonably good. There are many, many people there who are essentially living normal lives, except that because of the premature aging situation, they're getting many of the comorbidities associated with aging. We can't forget about that. We've got to make sure we care for them and develop better approaches to therapy and prevention of those comorbidities as these people get older. Just because their HIV is under good control with antiretrovirals doesn't mean we forget about them.
Do we still see a lot of stigma, or do you still see a lot of stigma around HIV/AIDS, you know, 40 years on?
Much less so now as a total nation, but there are parts of the country that dominate HIV now. And interestingly, if you look at the heat map of the country, of the infections in different parts of the country, the newer infections are restricted geographically to like 48 out of 3,000 counties in the United States. But there are seven states in the middle and southern part of the country in which the rural aspect of HIV looms large. So people who are living with HIV, who are contracting HIV, are predominantly an African-American men who have sex with men rural population. Under those circumstances, the stigma is very significant. And that's something that, you know, we may have gotten rid of a lot of it, not all of it, in the New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, New Orleans area, but it's alive and well, unfortunately, in some of the rural areas. And that's something we've got to fight against.
Is it time, do you believe then again, sir, for there to be a concerted effort to have a very big sort of like public awareness campaign? I mean, I remember back in the 1980s as a young man when AIDS was sort of at its height, HIV/AIDS was at its height, that there was television commercials, there was billboards. I mean, it was plastered everywhere and it was scary. I'm not suggesting that we go to that sort of level again because we know a lot more about HIV/AIDS, but is it time for us to bring the awareness back?
Well, it is, but it's going to be much more difficult back then because I think you used the right word. I remember very, very well. There was fear in the air. Walk down the street in the Castro District of San Francisco, you know, walk along Christopher Street in the Greenwich Village, you know, and there was this palpable feeling of anxiety as you looked around and saw people. You could tell just from looking at them, cachectic with Kaposi lesions on their face. Those were horrible years. I remember them very, very well. I still have a bit of a post-traumatic stress disorder from it, to be quite honest with you. But to get that message across now is needed, yes, you're right, but it's going to be very difficult because it isn't as scary now as it was then, particularly in light of very good therapy and prevention modalities like PrEP for people who want it, who need it, who use it. We do have to, if we want to end it, we have to have a different kind of campaign, and it may not be a campaign on fear. It may be a campaign on, okay, it's been 40 years now, let's get this damn thing out of here. You know, that kind of approach, and just end it so we don't have to worry about it in a pandemic way throughout the world, including in the United States. You know, we have 38,000 cases every year, and we've had that for over a decade. That's unacceptable. We got to bring that down. Got to bring it down to a couple of thousand a year at the most for the entire country. 38,000 is orders of magnitude higher than it should be.
Do you think part of that problem, sir, though, is that the healthcare system or the way that healthcare is set up in this country probably needs to be reviewed so that people can actually get access to, you know, these medications, things sure. like PrEP? And also, I believe that Medicare itself is changing as well, so that hopefully more people can get access to, you know, medications that way.
Absolutely. In fact, I have a slide that I show about places where there are clinics where you can get PrEP or where their people know about PrEP. And what the distance of driving from a particular area where there's a high incidence of HIV. And like some of them is like 100 miles away. I mean, I cannot imagine. I'm here in Washington, D.C. I could jog out from this building and be in 10 places that I can get PrEP in 5 minutes. So, I mean, that's unacceptable that people have to get in the car and drive for over an hour to be able to do that.
Final question to you, Doctor, and thank you ever so much for your time. I didn't want to mention COVID, but there is sort of a link to this. As we potentially see a vaccine on the horizon for COVID, do you think that what we have seen by way of pushing to find, you know, a vaccine for this particular condition, could it start to accelerate maybe more of the research or possibly, you know, a vaccine or something else for HIV/AIDS?
Yeah. No, I think the success of a vaccine excites people. Everybody's excited about the Pfizer success, and hang on to your coattails because there's going to be a few more that are going to be successful, and they're going to be soon, like in the next few weeks to a month. I think you're going to hear about it. I think that you know, you could kind of feel the important impact of a vaccine, and that's the reason why we're putting so much effort in an HIV vaccine, which would be much more difficult than a COVID vaccine, I can tell you.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. It's been a pleasure talking to you, sir. Thank you for your time. And I'd like to wish you a happy 80th birthday, which is coming up at the end of the year.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on your program.
And thank you for looking after the public as well for so many years, sir.
Thank you.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. The Connecticut Port Authority has thrown a temporary lifeline to the owner of a salt business at State Pier in New London. Steve Farrelly, owner of Driven, and his wife Michelle met with the new executive director of the CPA recently after they sent a letter to the governor asking for him to intervene and help them save their business from bankruptcy. Farrelly had been given until the end of December of this year to clear out the salt and his business, but has been unable to find a suitable new location for the tons of salt he needs to store. The CPA has granted Farrelly an initial extra month until the end of January 2021 and say they will review the situation with him on a month-by-month basis. Work to start redeveloping State Pier is supposed to start sometime in February. However, as yet, the CPA do not have the required permits for work to proceed. Meanwhile, Associated Builders and Contractors of Connecticut, who represent the construction industry in the state, have called out the Connecticut Port Authority over their $157 million State Pier project in New London. Chris Frixel is president of ABC Connecticut and says the CPA has added a project labor agreement clause to the State Pier project, which stops many local construction companies from bidding for the work.
It is anti-competitive. It prevents fair and open competition for all contractors, as it requires the use of union workers for all or almost all of the work being done. This is about this project, but it's also about some projects moving forward that we want to be sure that, one, they're bid fairly and openly, competitively, and that good quality contractors are being selected at a fair price.
Under state law, a project labor agreement can only be added if determined it's in the public's best interest. Frixel says he made a Freedom of Information inquiry with the CPA over the clause, and they have been unable to provide the necessary documentation showing why or how they came to the decision to include the clause. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, as teachers' unions call for public schools across Connecticut to transition to remote learning amid rising cases of COVID-19, state leaders maintain that in-person learning remains the best option for students and that the choice of learning formats is a decision best left to local leaders. The Board of Education Coalition, a group of unions representing teachers and school employees in Connecticut, released a report calling for remote learning during the holidays unless the state strengthens guidelines for reporting cases of COVID-19 in schools. In one of his regular COVID-19 briefings, Governor Lamont said schools have done an extraordinary job putting public health and safety first. He said the state has worked to get schools protective equipment, ventilation and disinfectant, and to ensure that any student, teacher or staff member who wanted a test could have one. In Norwich Bulletin this week, a 56-year-old Pomfret man was charged with overseeing a marijuana cultivation operation at his home. On September 29th, detectives from the statewide Narcotics Task Force North Central and East offices, with assistance from members of the Massachusetts Army National Guard, conducted a marijuana eradication operation in several towns in eastern Connecticut. Investigators converged on marijuana growing operations in Pomfret, Ashford and Tolland, where more than 80 plants were seized. Officials said the plants were fully mature with an average height of 5 feet. In all instances, detectives said they were able to identify the suspects growing the plants. Sean Cook of 54 Coval Road in Pomfret was arrested and charged with cultivation of marijuana, possession of marijuana and possession of marijuana with intent to sell. Police said Cook had 15 fully mature marijuana plants on his property. He was released on a $10,000 bond and is scheduled to appear in Danielson Superior Court on December 10th. In the Middletown Press this week, Holiday on Main Street in Middletown Chairman Alvin Santostefano says the event will be very different from what residents normally see, but he thinks that people will be pleasantly surprised with what the committee has decided to do. The event, dubbed Magic of Middletown 2020, is the 35th annual holiday event on Main Street. Similar to previous years, the event is being held downtown on weekends from Thanksgiving to Christmas. Usual traditions have been altered to ensure every activity is socially distant and safe for all to attend. In prior years, the celebration began with a community tree lighting that attracted nearly 3,000 people. Instead, the city lighting of the tree will take place virtually, as the event's popularity and location make it almost impossible for social distancing in person. In the Chronicle this week, the Mansfield Public Library is once again closing its doors to the public due to the spike in COVID-19 cases. The library is now closed until it is deemed safe to reopen, according to Mansfield Public Library Director Leslie McDonough. Curbside service is still available along with computer use, which will be available by appointment only at the main branch located on 54 Warrenville Road. Making the decision to close the library was prompted by Mansfield being put on red alert status recently, meaning the latest state report showed there were 15 or more COVID-19 cases per 100,000 people in the community. And the annual Click It or Ticket campaign across the state has kicked off. The Connecticut Department of Transportation, Office of Highway Safety and Law Enforcement agencies will be enforcing seatbelt use until December 3rd to cover the Thanksgiving holiday period. In 2018, nearly half of the 22,697 passenger vehicle occupants killed in crashes were unbuckled, and more of them are male than female. Among young adults aged 18 to 34 killed in crashes in 2018, more than half were completely unrestrained, one of the highest percentages for all age groups. In Connecticut, statewide seatbelt use increased to 93% in 2019, up from 92% in 2018. Connecticut law requires all drivers and passengers in the front seat, regardless of the occupant's age, as well as all children under 16 in all parts of a vehicle to wear a seatbelt. Fines start at a minimum of $92 for a first offense. And in next week's Connecticut East This Week, we talk with Greg Howard, the new state representative for the 43rd District of Stonington and North Stonington, who beat incumbent Kate Rotella in the recent elections. Howard is a serving police officer with Stonington PD, a family man and football coach, and has drawn praise and some criticism on his win. We'll find out more about Howard and what his plans are to serve his constituents when the new legislative session starts in January 2021. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.